Pardon? Sure, okay. That's okay. We'll get.
I took this much more literally. I wondered how many of us in the McCarthy era would have been willing to stand up for our neighbors who were accused of being communists if that meant that our own careers would be ruined and our family lives.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about that because I heard a discussion on NPR raising exactly that point about Margaret McCarthy or whatever her name is who got,
And how many of us in Germany in the 40s would have been willing to speak out as opposed to standing passively by, which was in itself a destructive act?
Yeah.
Not necessarily.
Well,
family
life. Okay. I think your points are very valid, but again, there are several slippery slopes here, and Steve's just raised one of them. It's interesting you raised that one, because I just saw a play on that subject on Saturday night, down at the Mark Taper, which if they hadn't put the love story element in it, would have been a very powerful play.
That's exactly what I heard about it.
Yeah, and that really killed it. But without that, it was... it was pretty solid. We have three levels of experience, at least. There is the world we live and our relationship with the society and environment. There's our all of the emotions that come up and our relationship with all of that internal material. And then at the deeper level, there is the relationship with ignorance itself and to what extent that we indulge it. I mean, what in Tibetan tradition, you had the three vows. The monastic ordination or individual liberation, individual freedom, the bodhisattva vow, the awakening being, and the vajrayana, or knowledge holder. And basically, those three vows work at those three levels. In the individual freedom vow, those are about specific actions that you take in the world. At the bodhisattva vow, it's very much about intention and how you approach the world. And at the Vajrayana or knowledge hold, it's how you experience the world. That's a very hard vow to keep. Atisha said, the monastic ordination, never broken that. Bodhisattva vow, every couple of hours. Vajrayana, like rain. So keeping all three levels in mind, that's a full practice. Now, but I want to caution all of you here, and Raquel brought this point up at our last meeting, because we're raised in, many of us are raised in Christian traditions, and I can't speak for Judaism because I didn't grow up in Judaism, but I get the sense that guilt is also a little thing that operates in that culture, too. And because Judaism is based on a sense of law, we are very conditioned to regard moral precepts, we even have that term, as prescriptive. This is the way you're meant to behave. And I know that... when I was working with Ajahn Amaro and Yvonne, one of the points they kept bringing out from the Theravadan and the Zen traditions is that this is not so much how you're meant to behave, this is how an awakening being behaves. So it's a description rather than a prescription. And that's why I emphasized the point last week is to approach this as a practice. not as you do this or you go to hell. I mean, on a cheery note on that, Jan Conchondral, who is one of the great 19th century teachers, writes in his biography, if what it says in the sutras is true, the best of us are going straight to hell. So what do? Savor it. What do you do with the practice? You make an effort, and you know, all of you know this from your meditation practice, you fall out of attention, you wake up from that, you clean up the mess as best you can, and you go on. And you keep making the effort, you keep making the effort, you keep making the effort. Whether it's returning to the breath or one's moral code or whatever, you just keep making the effort. And that way there's a sense of, well, there is a development, there is a cultivation, but you aren't getting into this really tight mind, which is very counterproductive. And I've talked about this before. I can remember talking about it in our Tuesday class a couple of years ago. It's very important. This is really important in your meditation and in your life. If you can meet difficulty and stay soft inside, then meet it all the way.
Then what?
Meet it all the way. That's in your meditation, in your life. But once your mind hardens up, then you're probably reinforcing problematic tendencies in you. You've got to change the way you're working with the situation. You may have to get out of it. Developing a hard, brittle mind is really not helpful. And that's something to watch for in one's practice. And in one's interaction with people in life, anytime you sense that hardness, I mean that's a number one alarm bell. That you're protecting something, you're blocking something, you're suppressing something, and so even how you're behaving, you're no longer acting. And even if you're behaving very well, you're no longer in full attention, in full presence. The hardness? Well, you described it when you said, I'm afraid of dying. It's like, bang, there's a wall there. Okay. Now you start working with that wall. And you begin to feel it. And I suspect that as you feel it, you'll begin to notice that it's not just here and there. It's all over the place. It's always present. And when you begin to sense that, that means you're beginning to move out of full identification with it. It's beginning to become workable. But it's a process. You follow? You need more? Okay. Any other points about your experience with reflection? Okay, fire away, Joe.
When I thought about expressing what had happened to me, I the first way I thought about expressing it was with the words, it was a pun of, you know, drive all threats into one. What I meant by that was that, again, trying to bring down what looks like a description of a larger world into the immediate by recognizing that I can see my happiness disappear just like that right now in a given moment,
mm-hmm.
and reappear or not. But I found it interesting that I used the word threat, and it reminded me that and this came up mainly in eight, it reminded me that it's really hard for me to not posit somebody or something
threatening me with punishment.
So when I read something like Suffering in the Lower Realms, it's really hard to endure. I always hear, you better do this.
Or else.
Or else.
Yes.
And I rebel.
Yes, okay. This is precisely where the process of reflection is really important, and it's reflection more than meditation. Because we have our background, and that's how we were brought up, that moral authority comes from outside. And when it says, the sage says, it is the result of destructive actions, suffering in the lower realms. Buddha didn't say, if you disobey me, you will be damned. That occurs in other traditions. Okay. What Buddha said was, this is how it works. If you do this, you're going to experience that. That's just how it works. He didn't say, I made it that way, or I'm going to punish you, or anything like that. He said, this is just how it works. And what the purpose of our reflections are, is to see if that's how it works for us too. Buddha is saying, this is how it works for me. This is what I've seen. But he also said, you've got to take my words and see if they're true for you. So when he says that, you've got to see if this is true. When you suffer, what is the genesis of that suffering? Now, I just described to you an incident I had last week, which is causing me a good bit of suffering. But I'm actually quite grateful for it, because it's a nice reminder. You know, there are certain kinds of situations where I tend to lose attention. It's a reminder to me. That's how I'm using it. You follow? But I don't have any idea, any sense that somebody's doing this or somebody's telling me. Now, sometimes, like you, I will get a little rebellious, and I'll get and I'll just say, "Oh, the hell with the whole thing." But you know why I go there? It's exactly the same reason you go there. Because right there, there's something I'm unwilling to experience. That's where it all starts. Right there. So when you are becoming rebellious, you can use that as like an alarm bell. I'm feeling rebellious now. Oh. What am I unwilling to experience? Can you use that?
Yeah.
Yeah. What am I unwilling to experience right now? That I'm alone and afraid and I'm miserable. Of course I don't want to experience.
Reminds me of that thing we discussed last week about a given situation in which you can either find energy for practice, ally with,
yeah, that's
or
right.
Go away from.
Yeah. And that goes to the point I was making earlier about being soft. If you can't experience it and stay soft, then you leap. But you leave in a good way, you just don't engage any action. But if you can actually experience it to whatever extent and stay soft, then you start that transformation process.
Could you describe soft again?
Well, rather than do it with anger, let's do it with desire. You see something. And you like it. Like, oh, I don't need it. And then something hardens in you.
Really?
Something hardens in you. Do you know what I mean? That's the opposite of soft.
You mean like, I don't deserve it, or I'm never going to have it.
Or, I've got to have it. Mm-hmm. It can go any direction.
Yeah.
But that's the opposite of soft. It's when there's some kind of imperative. It's this way. And you can feel the loss of flexibility in your system. Okay.
Isn't it accompanied by an actual physical tensing and relaxing?
Usually, I don't want to say always, because the same process happens at fairly deep states of mind, but there's probably something physically going on, but certainly in our own experience, yeah. And if you and you're referring to another principle which I found very useful, is use your body to tell you what's happening, because the body is very reliable.
So would you experience desire the same way that you describe experiencing fear? Attention, that is, you experience the desire and the feelings in your body and the way you feel about the desire, and yet in attention, not act automatically on it one way or the other?
Well, let's not talk about this theoretically. We did this a couple of years ago, but it's probably worth repeating. Everybody, pick an object that you really like. Now, it can be your partner, it can be some clothes, it can be a piece of music, it can be a sight, it can be a book, whatever, a flower, it doesn't matter. Just pick something you really like, something you desire, okay? Now, imagine the object in front of you, whatever or whoever it is, and let yourself feel how much you want it. And just let yourself feel. Often people are a little uncomfortable about feeling that, but just for the purposes here, just let yourself feel how much you want it. And note all of the experiences that have come with that wanting. What's happening in your body? What are the emotions coming? Doubt about your worthiness, feelings of entitlement, all of that stuff. Maybe there's a certain arrogance, maybe there's a certain fear. And all of the stories. This should be mine. I'm not worthy of it. You know, same thing, but level of stories. So you're right in the experience of wanting it. Now look right at the experience of wanting, which you've brought up quite vividly, and ask yourself, what is this? Don't try to answer that question. Just ask that and look right at it. Rest in the looking for a moment. Now, staying right there, look at the object. And observe how you experience it now. Okay, what was your experience here?
I found myself trying to recreate the pleasurable experience and had nothing to do anymore with the object.
Okay, anybody else?
I experienced emptiness, actually.
found the puzzle. I just felt an increase of desire. I really, really want this.
Keep going.
And it, you know, in terms of the visualization, it just, it was a thing. It just got bigger and bigger. In real life, it's a small thing, but it just got huge. It just filled, you know, my whole perception of it.
Okay.
And it's like I wanted to dive into it and sort of be it. And but then I thought, if I, now I'm doing this sort of ad hoc, now I'm thinking, if I dive into this and I be it, then I'd be dead. I mean, really.
Well.
And that's very frightening.
Yeah. But in all the comments, you notice there's been a shift in one's relationship with the object, and there's been a shift in increased attention. Yeah. You can you play with this one over the next week. Keep doing it. Yeah. And but don't dive into it, because we'd like you to come back. Okay. This is a way of being able to experience attraction or liking and being soft at the same time. There's that openness. You don't actually have to act. Did anybody of you experience a heightened appreciation of the object?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Actually, like, it's as if I saw the object.
For the first time,
I
yeah.
Like,
yeah. As the object, rather than as something that was going to fulfill you. Yeah, that's right. Okay. I have a question about verse 9. Since nobody raised it, I'll ask it.
I have a question.
It's all right, I'm first. This highest level of freedom is one that never changes. Was that your question?
Yes, I didn't understand.
Okay. Well, you and I are in the same boat here, Diane. We'll just have to rely on everybody else. What does this mean?
I thought it meant a vivid and a clear awareness that was in one of the other verses that leads to increased confidence in being.
Okay.
Very similar.
Right. Anybody else? Robert?
To me, it felt like the open sky and having everything else just float by within it, but there you were open.
That never changes. That's what killed me. Because what never changed? It's always
right.
Changes and it doesn't exist. So that's what never
changed.
So
I got
nothing. Yeah. Julia?
I thought about it in terms of like the one taste. Freedom comes from being able to experience everything without preference.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is this helping you yet?
No, this is very weird because when I read, I really did get hung up on that one line. That's an esteemed Buddhist teacher once told me that everything changed, nothing. So that was part of my problem, but somehow this really affected me all throughout the week, and I noticed everything that was changed.
Uh-huh.
So there was just something in there, but I really could not interpret that.
So it aroused your curiosity, did it?
I don't know.
Well, it sounds like it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was
now,
curiosity.
The various responses, have they helped you?
Well,
ask for some more clarification. You can pick on anybody. Don't be.
Again, I just. What is it that doesn't change?
Okay. Susan.
The way I
thought of it was
you gotta help Diane now.
Okay. One thing that doesn't change is awakened mind, because it's not subject to suffering or impermanence or like that. And so when it's talking, the first line is talking about the happiness of the three worlds disappears in a moment. In our regular day-to-day lives, the kinds of things that we think that we're getting happiness from don't last. So the only thing that does is if we keep cultivating our waking mind, and that's not subject to those kinds of conditions.
Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
You sure?
Yeah, although
good. That's what I like. I like that although.
I don't know what I think of that aspect of awakening mind. I see it changing in that it adapts to the situation. You come up with the right action for each situation because you're in a state of awakening. And so in that sense, there's something that's always.
So do you know what your task is right now, Susan?
Help her move into her experience.
Well, yes, but it's a little more explicit than specific than that. It's a very general statement. Mm-hmm. Okay. For you, awakening mind and not changing, those are not contradictory, right? For her, they are. Okay? So you've got to elicit in her something of your experience. Go ahead. Yes, because you have a certain experience. And she doesn't. So now you've got to elicit in her something of your experience. That's your task. Everybody following this? Okay, good. Good luck. You have 5 seconds. I will give you a hint. Do you want a hint? You cannot use concepts. Got somebody.
I'm getting some. Might be good advice.
Come on, let her work it out.
Could you repeat the last thing you said?
No, <I'm laughs>
close as you can.
Yeah. Yeah. Awakening mind to me seems like there's a changing aspect to it, in that. When you're in the state of awakened mind, you approach, you come up with the right action for each circumstance. It's very adaptive. You're in a state of awakened mind, and you instinctively do what is the right thing.
Sounds good. So, I get the concept, but I can't move it into it.
Okay. Can I give you another hint?
Yeah.
Don't think.
Don't think of that elephant.
I'm serious. Stop thinking.
But I had to take it what she said.
Yeah, don't think. You don't need to think to take in what she said.
Okay. So what is adapting to what?
Very good. Next question. You okay, Kate? Okay. Other questions? Okay.
Did we answer that question already?
About freedom?
That it is unchangeable. I mean, are you agreeing or disagreeing?
I hate to say this, but
it doesn't matter.
It's irrelevant. What do you experience?
Well, I just looked at the Dalai Lama and he gave me the answer, so. And he said it is unchangeable, so I believe him.
Ah. Your comment, Dave?
I couldn't help it. Big mistake came across my mind.
Pardon?
Yeah.
Because of the belief. I believe him.
Yeah, I
should
believe him.
Yeah, well, I think. In Dual Ornament of Liberation, in reference to awakening mind, it talks about four levels. I can't remember all four. But the first is we find out about it through the intimations of others. Okay. Well, that arouses our curiosity. It may even inspire us. But because it comes from others, it is necessarily weak. Okay? And the kind of understanding that we're seeking to cultivate, all of this material, is not from the words of others, even though many of us are conditioned to absorbing the words of others. And this is why we engage in the process of reflection, because it is through the process of reflection that we move out of belief. It makes sense to us. And so if there's a point in here that you're not comprehending or you can't take in, and you may find inspiration in thinking of the Dalai Lama, and said, okay, yeah, well, that's the sense I get. What actually is being pointed to there is there something in you that does understand it or feels it or some way. And that's the thing to bring out until it becomes quite explicit in you. And then you won't be believing it anymore. It will make sense to you in your own terms. And that is the purpose of the second stage, is to get to that point where it makes sense to us on our own terms, not because it's coming from anybody outside. And that's really important in all of this stuff. Follow? Okay, we just have a couple of minutes left. For time without beginning, 8, 9, and 10, mothers have lovingly cared for you. If they are still suffering, how can you be happy? What came up for you with these lines? Julia?
Well, I choked on. Mothers have lovingly cared for me. So I spent some time on that. And I reflected on it. And two things came up for me. One was that there were many times when my mother did lovingly care for me, even though it was then the second thing that came up for me is how many people in the world act with, you know, giving me kindness and care. I have acted as a mother in my life.
Yeah.
So I sort of reflected through it, if you like.
That's good. Yep. If they are still suffering, how can you be happy? Came up for you there? I mean, very clearly, there appear to be large numbers of people in this country who feel they can be quite happy even when there are other people suffering, a lot of other people suffering. I had experience where when I thought of it globally, I felt that, so then I brought it to my own level.
Yeah.
And then I went, no, I could not.
Okay.
And then I realized that it's making the connection.
That's right.
Because I couldn't feel it at first until I made it really specific.
Okay. And again, Clint, going back to your question of last week, that's another technique. When you're working with these phrases, we've run into it already, is okay, there's a line. Make it into a very, very specific situation. And is it true here? How do I experience it there? It's a very good technique for making these lines come alive. Okay. Anybody else on this? Susan?
How do you explain Theravada or Hinayana?
Well, I can explain Hinayana. Hinayana is a straw man set up by the Mahayanists, knocked down. Okay? So when they say the Pratyeka Buddhas don't have highly developed compassion, that was a way of being able to make the Mahayana look good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the Hinayana, as a reflection of Theravadan practice, is a bit distorted. There are some very interesting points that are, and I've had some good discussions. But when you probe beneath the surface, the differences that you read about in the sutras just aren't there. So that's very much. And the other side, because I have a teacher's group, and there's a person who's just really, really knowledgeable about Theravadan. In it, and he's a very, very good and very knowledgeable person, and we were looking at the first verse of the Dhammapada, and I brought in a Mahayana translation, a translation from the Tibetan tradition, and which translated quite differently, and I made a comment, and he said, "Oh, you Mahayana essentialists," and I just had to laugh because it's the first time I realize that the Theravadins have set the Mahayanas up as straw men too. You know, because they think about Buddha nature, which is, when you really think about it, very, very close to positing a self. And so they say, oh, you think there's an essence to you? No, 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 no.
Can
so.
I interrupt?
Sure.
Last time you were talking about this is off the wall, but some very advanced practitioner's way of looking at taking refuge in the Buddha.
Yes.
And there were sort of three aspects. One was clarity. What were the other two?
And these are actually on the website in the refuge section. But to take refuge in the Buddha means to know the emptiness of mind. To take refuge in the Dharma is to know the clarity of mind. To take refuge in the Sangha is to be. You talk with a path developed the way it is in the Mahayana. They use loving kindness. Or some of the traditions use loving kindness to power practice in the same way that the Mahayanists use compassion to power practice. But the characterizations which you find in the Mahayana texts don't apply to the practice of Theravada. No. Yeah, it's quite amusing, actually. Okay. Next week...